This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.
This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Barron's Live MarketWatch Edition. I'm Jeremy Olshan, the editor of MarketWatch, and with me is Lucas Alpert, who has, I think as I've said before, one of the best beats on the site, Financial Crime. Welcome, Lucas, and thank you for doing this.
No problem. I always love to talk about financial crime.
You know, reading through all the stories you've done, you know, the past few months, I mean, one theme, and we've talked about this before, that comes through is hubris. And I was just reading this book on how Greek mythology applies to modern life. And in mythology, hubris was always what brought people down. You know, it's Icarus flying too close to the sun, and, you know, King Midas, you know, absurd gold wish. And your stories all seem to involve similar kinds of absurd level of hubris and people getting their comeuppance.
Oh, I think that's really very much the theme of the whole thing. It's always that somebody finds like some weird loophole or some, you know, kink in the system that allows them to, you know, pocket a few extra dollars here and there, and then they just keep doing it, and they do it again and again, and finally that number just gets too big for like nobody to notice anymore. And that's always just like that one, they just steal money one time too many, you know, and it just, that's what always gets them caught. They just, you know, I always wonder, I'm like, do you not think somebody's going to notice that you just took like $17 million? Like, you know, how they think that they don't get caught, but they apparently they don't, because they get caught all the time.
You should use the proceeds to buy like a Toyota, not a Lamborghini.
Exactly. You know, so
we also,
you know,
offer tips to financial fraudsters.
Right, exactly. I mean, so, you know, looking ahead of, you know, the year to come, I mean, it's like experts always would tell you, you know, look at the old tried and true mantra, follow the money. So wherever the money is, that's where the scammers are going to go. So what in this coming year, where's the big money coming from? It's going to be, well, probably a lot of scams are going to pop up around the infrastructure bill that just got passed. That's $1.2 trillion about to be, you know, pumped into the system. So some of it's going to go awry. And if, you know, the Build Back Better plan gets passed, that's like even more. So, you know, this stuff goes in cycles. So, you know, people will, you know, scammers will do that. They'll go to where the money is. And, you know, it usually takes like a year or 18 months for like prosecutors and regulators to kind of figure it out. And then you start seeing a spate of prosecution. So what we've seen in the last year in 2021 was, you know, all the people who ripped off the PPP loans and the EIDL loans, like there's a lot of prosecutions going on there. So there was a lot of really curious and wacky stuff that popped up around that program.
You had a stat, it was I think out of the $3.5 trillion in aid, there was $100 billion in fraud. It's something like almost 3%.
Yeah, it was, that was the Secret Service put that figure out like in November. That was their estimate, that $100 billion of the $3.5 trillion went awry, and they're, you know, working to claw that back. And there's just literally every day somebody's being indicted for, you know, lying on their applications and saying they had a company with 500 employees when they had like none, you know, or, you know, they were just submitting documents that were just made up, fake tax returns, that whole thing. So, you know, then they're now getting caught for a variety of reasons. And
all right, so let's go through some of the the more egregious examples. And also, those watching this, if you have questions as we go, you know, please put them in the chat. We'll try to get to as many as we can at the end.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think we could start with, you know, one of the ones that really like jumps out are always the things that jump out is that people go and buy luxury cars. I don't know. This is a thing people have. I'm not a big, like, you know, I'm not interested in Italian sports cars that you can't drive really anywhere. But You know, Lamborghinis, very popular among the PPP loan fraudsters. So we had one case in March. There was a guy down in Texas. He gets busted. He apparently used the proceeds of his PPP loans to buy a fleet of luxury cars, including a Corvette Stingray, a Porsche Macan, and a Bentley, a convertible Bentley that apparently cost $250,000. He bought homes. You know, he was $17 million. You can do a lot with that. So, but, you know, that's not going to go unnoticed. And it didn't in his case. We had another case where a guy, he was the very first person to be arrested for COVID-19 relief aid fraud. This was at the very beginning. It was like in May of 2020. So it was like, I think somebody sort of tipped the FBI off, and they went and they arrested him. He was filing for restaurants that he didn't actually own. You know, it's like trying to get PPP loans and, you know, trying to get $500,000. And he fakes his own suicide. You know, he's been arrested. He's got a monitoring brace, cuts it off, like, you know, leaves his car by the ocean in Rhode Island somewhere. And, you know, with a note, and then he goes on the lam. But, you know, the marshals caught up with him, and, you know, he's now in jail. You know, so there was that one. We have this one just came across.
That one should be a movie. That one.
I mean, it was, you know, the thing when that one was funny was it was like his relatives said something along the lines of like, well, you know, when they were told, you know, he faked his suicide, and they're like, well, that makes sense. This is just kind of the guy he was. So yeah, I think he was like people who knew him, like, you know, they knew what he was up to. So
that's a good sign, really. You fake your suicide, people are like, of course you did.
Right. there was one just like a couple weeks ago down in Florida, a guy who was he was like an Instagram influencer. He did a lot of like, you know, how to like make yourself rich kind of lifestyle kind of pictures. You know, he'd have pictures of him in like really flashy suits and standing in front of cars, again a Lamborghini. He was apparently he's been arrested and he's charged with stealing $2.1 million in PPP loans, with part of which he used to buy a $225,000 Lamborghini Hurricane. He bought Rolexes and Hublot watches and, you know, Vuitton and Gucci and Chanel clothes. You know, he was really, you know, kind of living it up. So or accused, allegedly. So he's, you know, he's in, facing trial now. And then there was one in Philadelphia, which is this was one I liked. He was a guy, he'd served 21 years for murder. This was back in the 90s. He was like a teenager. He shot some guy outside a basketball game, did his time, came out within a week, was filing for a PPP loan fraudulently, and some unemployment insurance that he wasn't eligible for because he'd been in jail. And he got caught right away, and he's going back to jail now. I guess he liked it in there. And then we had a really good one that we wrote. This one got a lot of attention. It was an Olympic speed skater, a woman named Allison Baver. She was 2010. She, you know, was a part of the bronze medal speed short form speed skating relay team. They won the bronze. She had since, you know, she's not skating anymore, you know, not professionally. And so she had started a film production company, film and TV production business in Utah. And she apparently filed for a PPP loan saying that she had 450 employees, something like that, and got $10 million. So she had zero employees. And, you know, so she took some of that $10 million and allegedly used it to finance an Elijah Wood movie. It was some biopic on Ted Bundy that came out last year. I don't know if she, you know, she got a producer credit. She put in like $150,000 towards that. And now she's been arrested and charged with, you know, stealing this money. So she is.
So she actually did help fund this movie with.
She did. Yeah, partly. I don't know if she'd done anything with the rest of it, but yeah, some of it actually went and financed a film. So she was, you know, genuinely trying to, you know, start, you know, keep her business up and running, but, you know, she, you know, lied about how to do that and got money that really should have gone to somebody else. It's really the ultimate. These are not victimless crimes, I think, is the point.
Well, it's more that we're talking about speed skating than usually happens in except every 4 years,
right? Exactly. I don't know. It's you know, not something I really have. The Olympics. I know the Olympics are coming up.
Yeah.
But you know, it's like you usually don't think about the short track speed skater. Like, I don't know, it's an event I don't follow. But there it is.
And so these PPP frauds, is that the pace of those still going strong, or, you know, has that?
Yeah. Great... It's like, I mean, I follow, you know, the filings from the U.S. Attorney's offices around the country, and there's almost one a day, you know, where somebody's getting nabbed for these, you know, because it's really, it's kind of hit its stride now. I think, as I said, it's sort of a pattern. It's like, you know, they go, you know, somebody does the theft. It probably takes, you know, 10 months for some, you know, the IRS to start really like looking at the stuff. I think where most people got caught is that they were claiming to have a lot of employees, and now the IRS is kind of looking, doing an audit, and they're like, you know, you never paid any payroll tax. What's going on here? That's a pretty major discrepancy. You know, then they start to look, and I think that, you know, it all falls apart rather quickly. I mean, the big sort of loophole with the PPP program was that the lenders who were the middlemen in this, you know, they were sort of given the instructions from the federal government to just get that money out there as fast as possible. They wanted to keep the economy flowing. So as long as you were submitting the requisite documents, there wasn't a lot of oversight at the beginning. They were just cutting the check. So people were forging tax returns. I mean, that was really ultimately and payroll documents. They were just making them up, and, you know, it looked good on the surface, and but yeah, closer look under the hood. Now these guys, it's popping up. I mean, it's like almost in every jurisdiction. It was all over the country. So, you know, they're clawing it back as best they can. You know, they'll never get it all, but, you know, there we are.
Great. And another theme that, you know, there were a bunch of stories that fell into is various inside jobs at companies. You know, it's of course pretty common. There's one you could talk us through that involved, you know, probably the most creative use of credit card refunds I've ever seen before.
Yeah. So, I mean, in these cases, it's oftentimes like, you know, the person who's closest to you is the one who's like to watch out for. So, you know, a lot of companies, small companies out there, you know, they'll have like a CFO or a controller or, you know, some payroll person who, you know, has access to all the books, you know, and has check writing authority. In this case, it was a company in Ohio, I believe. It was a Gateway Packaging Corporation. They made boxes, basically, and, you know, not a big company, but, you know, they employed like, you know, dozens of people. It was an old company, family run business, and they had a controller who worked for them for years, and she had figured out a way to basically, you know, use the corporate credit card, make charges, and then get refunds issued for the charges, but she would steer the refund into her own bank account. So she was basically skimming all this money. And ultimately, in this case, it was really pretty tragic because, you know, it wasn't a big company, and she stole, you know, about $200,000, and it drove the company into bankruptcy. And all these people who had worked there for years, like, had to go on unemployment. It was really terrible. You know, she just, you know, these people trusted her, but you know, there she was. And, you know, this happens not infrequently, you know, with companies like this. They have somebody there that's worked there for a long time who's just, you know, they do it bit by bit. So it doesn't quite, you know, you don't catch it, but then ultimately, and I wrote one the other day where it was, woman, she was the CEO of like the U.S. arm of this German company that made saw blades, like, you know, tungsten carbide, you know, industrial equipment. And, you know, it was there in Germany, she's here in America, and she was basically embezzling like crazy. She stole, like, well, she's accused of stealing $15 million from this company. And, you know, they only caught on to it when suddenly, you know, like, checks are bouncing, you know, things, hey, how come the corporate credit card for this guy got rejected? Like, and, you know, so suddenly they take a look at the books and like, hang on, there's a giant hole in our accounting here. And, you know, now she's facing federal charges. She was using that money to, you know, had a side business selling like luxury clothing, and like she had like a boutique basically that she was financing, and, you know, taking her family on trips to New York and staying at the Plaza Hotel and, you know, those kind of things. She, you know, got away with it for a long time. There was another one in Massachusetts. This was last year. This was kind of a long story, but fancy shoe company, like a couple of hundred years old. They made, you know, very bespoke kind of men's, like, you know, dress shoes. And they had a CEO or CFO, sorry, worked for them for years and years and years. And he apparently fell in love with a woman who was a local TV anchor, who was unrequited, as I understand it. But, you know, she had ambitions to become a TV personality, and he just took it upon himself to finance the production of some talk show she was trying to do. And he stole $30 million from this company. And, you know, it was a family run business. They didn't go bankrupt, but I think that was a lot of the family's money, you know, stuff was so, and I, you know, that was basically was, you know, love. I mean, it was a kind of a really sad and pathetic story, and it was this unrequited thing, and you know, he really fell for this woman and just, you know, spent $30 million on her, and wow, you know, and
left with her career after that was,
well, the talk show didn't take off, yeah. So I think that got canceled, and you know, she's she had been like a local weather anchor person at one of the local Boston stations. I don't think she's there anymore, and you know, she's, as I understand, is trying to figure out her way in TV, but she doesn't have this, you know, financier at this point, you know.
Well, another theme that's run through your coverage, and it's already one I think popped into some of the questions you guys were asking, is crypto. Well, crypto, right. and SPACs as well are, I think, two areas we've seen growth in financial crime. Why don't you talk through some of the big ones? There was, you know, I mean, my favorite one you did involved Steven Seagal, you know, the former movie star who has dogged your whole career, Lucas. I know you've written about him.
I've written a lot about Steven Seagal. He pops up in a lot of places and not just in his movies. Yeah, I mean, so, you know, crypto, obviously new territory, you know, it's increasingly becoming regulated now as, you know, banks and regulators sort of figure out what to do with this thing. But, you know, there was a long period where this was a total free for all, and there was a lot of, you know, guys taking advantage of the appetite for it and the lack of real clear oversight. So the one around Seagal, I mean, he was sort of tangentially involved in it, what was a major fraud, but he was not like the active fraudster here. But these guys, it was a group of Serbian, I mean, they were basically, I think, you know, accused gangsters. They launched a coin. It was called B2G. It was like Bitcoin second generation. I think that's what it was called. And, you know, they did an offering, and they sold sort of stock in the company. They claimed they had a big mining operation, I think somewhere in China. I can't remember exactly the details, but they claimed to have this very large, well, you know, built out and established mining operation, which they did not, apparently. And, you know, they raised money from investors. You get a leg in, you'll get paid out early at a preferential rate on this new coin that we're going to offer. And it was a fraud. I mean, it was just, I won't even go so far as to say it was a Ponzi scheme, because I don't think they paid out to anybody. They just took the money and disappeared. You know, and they never paid anybody back. You know, they were people living in parts of the world that are not easy to get to. You know, it was a very kind of classic financial crime thing.
They got Seagal to promote this scam, right?
Exactly. At one point, they went to Seagal and they said, look, if we give you like, I think it was $250,000, we like basically promote it on your social networks. Because he's got like, you know, a million followers on Twitter and things like that. You know, he's got fans still, you know, and, so he did. He took the money and he said, you know, this is the greatest offering ever, and which was a violation of SEC rules, because he never disclosed that he was actually like being paid to do this. So he ended up paying a fine. I think it was like he was given $250,000. He had to pay the $250,000. To the SEC and fine, and $100,000 extra, you know, and he acknowledged, he said, look, his agent, I think, told me, was like, you know, he was as much a victim here as anybody else, because he didn't, you know, he thought they were legit. He didn't know. I mean, look, you know, they came, they were going to pay him to just say this stuff is great. So he did it, and he got in trouble for it. So, but there you go, Steven Seagal, right in the middle of a Bitcoin scam or crypto scam.
It probably won't be the last time we see celebrities promoting cryptos and NFTs and getting into trouble. There was just a case right now going on along those lines. What else crypto-wise?
We did a story. This is a whole scam where guys were doing phone spoofing. So they would like basically kind of take over your phone. They would get, they had somebody inside it, I believe it was at Verizon, who was, you know, helping them transfer control. You know, if you get a new phone, you port the phone system over from one device to another. You know, which if you're authorized to do is easy. They were not authorized to do it, but they figured out how to do this with the help of this insider. they would get the your phone would just be like taken over, and your whole operating system would be transferred over to a device that they had. And they would target people who kept their crypto wallets there, and they would like go in and like take your crypto. You know, they would tap into it. Sometimes they would blackmail people. They would, you know, you had photos on your phone that were maybe not what you wanted the world to see, and they would threaten, you know, we're going to send this to your family because now they have your whole phone book and everything. It was really sinister stuff. It was this whole crew of guys. They were all over the country. And the case we wrote about was a guy who was a student at the University of California in San Diego. So he was like 22 or something, you know, and he was like sort of part of this, and he was, you know, taking this money and, you know, living the high life, you know, it's just, you know, probably looking pretty good to his classmates. And, you know, but that's a, you know, they busted that one up. So there's that kind of stuff, you know, where guys like, you know, again, it's a follow the money kind of thing. They go, they see cryptos like sort of being hidden in these kind of corners, and you know, it's not in a vault or in a bank account that's harder to get to. It's like on your phone. Like if they get your phone, they figure out how to do it.
And that's the crazy thing, you know, as secure as crypto is, it's only as strong as the weakest link, which when there has been hacking, it always seems to be, it's not the blockchain itself being hacked in any way, it's the exchanges or you know, the apps, I guess, in this case.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, it's also like, you know, I mean, if you have your bank account broken into, you know, the bank will sort of vouchsafe for you, right, make you whole. Often sometimes it's an effort to do it, but you usually, your credit card gets ripped off, like the credit card companies stand with you. Crypto, you're kind of on your own in some ways, and there's not like the infrastructure isn't in place in the same way. You know, we sort of saw, I mean, we were talking about SPACs here, you know, so SPACs, again, kind of newish concept, and it sidesteps a lot of the, you know, the more robust kind of protections that the SEC has put in place for IPOs, which is, and we saw this happen in the launch of Nikola, the electric truck company. You know, the founder there, Trevor Milton, he was indicted or last year. For basically the lockout period where after an IPO happens, you're not allowed to discuss, you know, the company beyond what's in the publicly released documents, doesn't apply when there's a SPAC, because the public listing exists and it's just an acquisition. So he went out and was, you know, really hyping up this company in a way that he wouldn't have been able to if it was a traditional IPO. Obviously, he was kind of lying about what was there, and he, you know, roped in a lot of investors, you know, through some of things like Robinhood. You know, young people were really trying to get ahead of these things, and this was, became kind of a hot stock. And you know, it turned out these electric trucks that he was saying, you know, we have these prototypes and they work and stuff like that, was like all fraud. It was all a lie. The prototypes didn't work. They didn't have technology. They were, you know, sort of presenting trucks that, you know, sort of, you know, when they would roll them out, they were literally like plugged into the wall, you know, or, you know, put together out of Frankenstein parts from other vehicles kind of thing. So it was pretty bad. But, you know, he found this very obvious seam, was able to run up the value of this company very quickly because he didn't have that muzzle on him because of the structure of the SPAC.
That's some serious hubris.
Yeah, right.
Plugged into the wall.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, before we get to questions, there's some really fun, weird financial crime stories you've done. I think it's worth running through some of these.
Sure.
One of my favorites is probably the best scam involving a cow since Jack and the Beanstalk.
Right. Yeah, this one was a rancher in Colorado. He was trying to... the proposal was that he was trying to breed a new kind of cow. It was like a high alpine, you know, high altitude cow. You know, so they were, and you know, he went out and like got investors, you know, people who are, he apparently the guy himself, his name was Richard Sears. He ran a business that did like very high end hunting, like elk hunting out in Colorado. So, you know, he had these very wealthy kind of hunter outdoorsy type guys. So he sort of pitched them on this, and ultimately turned out to be a Ponzi scheme. You know, it was like,
well, there was no such thing, right, as a high altitude cow.
they were not able to do it, right? You know, or he was never able to really generate. I think there in theory you should have been able to do it, but he was not actually doing it. You know, so he sold them on this crossbreed of cow, and he had this very kind of elaborate thing where you would lend him the money, he would buy the cows and like manage them, take care of them, feed them, and then like would pay you a percentage he would, like, the cows would have babies, they would, you know, he would keep the babies, and whatever money he made off that, like, he would give you 10%, and eventually you could just like sell him your cow for full price or whatever, but, you know, like, never paid out. And you know, everybody who invested lost their shirts because it was a Ponzi scam. And, you know, usually Ponzi scams are just like around real estate or something, like kind of really anodyne, but this one was kind of weird because it was like about non-existent cows. It's kind of got my attention.
Excellent. All right, let's do one more before the question. This was our most read story of 2021, I think. And also, like, so many of these seems straight out of a movie, but
right.
involves... I mean, go ahead.
It's one of these things where you can't really believe. I was reading the court papers on this. I couldn't even really quite believe that this was for real. But so there's a casino in Los Angeles. It's called the Bicycle Casino. It's a card room. You basically go there. It's for high stakes poker. And they had apparently a guy who was a frequent visitor would come with like literally duffel bags full of cash. And he would swap them out for chips and, you know, play these marathon. He was a whale, as they call them in the gambling world. He would do these marathon, you know, card games, you know, for hours and hours and hours. And he would, you know, then what you're supposed to do, the casino, really, in the end, the casino got in trouble here, because when somebody does this, you know, you do a transfer of that cash in for chips, and then ultimately you cash out. It's essentially a mechanism that could be used for money laundering. So the casino is supposed to file with FinCEN, you know, that this happened, the transaction. And so what they did in this case is that the guy, he would have his assistant go and actually cash out, you know, cash in and cash out. So the assistant's name was showing up on the document, but it wasn't really the assistant's money. So ultimately, the casino like was hit with a fairly hefty fine for this. You know, it was an accounting mistake was how it was deemed. But, you know, there was obviously, like, they'd been under investigation for some time. There was another casino in LA that was shut down because of this. So I think this was a thing that was known and a concern for law enforcement as a money laundering venture, because, you know, you come in with dirty money, you exit with clean money. It's a very easy transaction. You know, but if it's, you know, handled properly, it should be okay. But they figured out a way around here to not handle it the right way. And, you know, the casino got zapped. They never identified the whale. So I don't know who it is. Somebody, it was a Chinese national, would fly to LA, like, do these, you know, crazy games and then like leave. You
probably
know?
George Clooney.
You know? Maybe. Right. Yeah. Like, right.
This is the low rent Ocean's 11 movie.
Right.
All right. Yeah, that's an amazing one. Mm. All right, we got a lot of good questions here. Let's try to get through some of these. So Jose asks, which three industries are most affected by fraud today? And where are the greatest, I guess, weaknesses right now?
Yeah, this is a good question. I mean, obviously, it's you know, banks are on, you know, are very attuned to keeping an eye out for this. But you know, it's like, so if you're in like more traditional banks, you're probably at the safest. But it's like, I think when you get into sort of the outer edges of the finance world, you know, crypto obviously like leaves a bunch of things open. You know, there's a bunch of frauds that go on where companies get zapped. There's this whole, like, it's called business email compromise, where, you know, basically get like real criminals, this is like hackers and criminals, like basically get into your email and, you know, company's email, and they figure out transactions are about to happen. You know, you're about to make a big payout to another company, and they would send it like a fake email purportedly from the other company, be like, when you make that payment, can you just put it in this account instead of the one you usually do? And it, you'd be surprised how often that actually works. And it does. And like money just gets like disappeared into the financial system and it's like gone before you know it. Anything that's very online obviously has a lot of vulnerabilities. I think that areas that, where you see a lot of problems is really just individuals. You know, a lot of people are, you know, like it's the classic thing, you know, people who are maybe not that sophisticated financially or, you know, or like elderly, you know, they really target like the real, like real criminals go after people like this. It's labor intensive, but it's effective. You know, companies are inured more so because they, you know, have people work on this and consultants and stuff. But going back to the
what you're saying about retailer non-financial companies being at greater risk because they haven't had the, you know, experience dealing with as much of this. It's, Doug had a related question. What can law enforcement regulators and financial institutions do to increase consumer and business awareness of these threats? I'll before I go to you, I'll plug a recent episode we did of the podcast to do the best new ideas in money. We looked at it's called behavioral biometrics, which the online retailers are sort of taking a page from the banks, looking at ways to help exactly the Doug's question, help people protect themselves by creating profiles of each of our behavior, like the way we type, how we hold our phone when we do certain things. And they, you know, they use all that to know if it's really you doing things without you actually being aware or having to identify which of these pictures isn't a fire hydrant or whatever.
Right.
You know, but you know, I think to Doug's point, like more education of consumers to prevent, you know, people falling prey to stuff is probably a big part of it.
I do think, yeah, there's a soft underbelly. You know, obviously the largest financial institutions have the resources to police this better. And, you know, they do things like even simple things like two-factor authentication. You know, that's very costly to actually implement. Like, so, you know, smaller banks, you know, regional banks have trouble with this. Retailers, obviously, this is like would be a big cost for them to implement it. I mean, it's very effective. Two-factor authentication is like, you know, kind of the gold standard for a lot of financial transactions. But it's, you know, it's only certain places really have the ability to do that. And that's where we sort of lie. And the scammers like kind of know that, you know, that there's still a lot of soft spots.
Yeah, I'm looking through. You know, we were not going to answer this one, but we, Lucas, you'll appreciate hearing. We got a question from our former colleague, Myron, at the New York Post. But Myron, if you're listening, we will have to get back to you later with that question.
Yeah, sure. Hi, Myron.
All right. Arturo says, just curious if you follow the anecdotal cases only for reporting and journalistic purposes. Do you have any, are there any interesting aggregate stats or trends? That you've seen financial crime.
Yeah, I mean, look, the obviously the big government agencies that track this, the FTC, you know, the Secret Service does this. You know, where they all usually at the beginning of a year will do like some data, around, you know, certain kinds of fraud. A lot of it is sometimes hard to totally understand the scope of things. I did a story this year about catalytic converter theft. I mean, this is a little off, like out of left field a bit, but you know, my catalytic.
You had personal experience with this crime.
Yeah, my catalytic converter was stolen from like literally a block away from my house. And, I realized that this is a big deal. And, you know, there's like the auto insurance, you know, association, like things like that. They do keep data on this, but it's like, it's always hard to stay totally current with it. It's like, you know, like the data was like 2 years old because it's, you know, it comes in kind of slow. So it is a bit piecemeal. There is data out there, you know, on the scope of it, but sometimes they're just big holes. And I struggle with that, trying to do these stories and contextualize them in the proper way. I mean, sometimes we just do these stories because they're just interesting and maybe there isn't like a broader context, but you know, there often is, and sometimes it's actually a bit of a challenge to fully understand that. I try my best, but you know, I don't always succeed.
All right, these questions are coming in fast. We're not going to be able to get to all of them probably, but we'll try to reply to afterwards, post some of this if we can. Let's see. I don't know if you're looking at the list too, if there are any jump out of you. Yeah, Alexander asks, are we seeing an uptick in charitable organizations fraudulently obtaining funds or...
I have not. I haven't seen that. It's not to say it's not happening. I mean, most of the frauds that you're seeing are coming from individuals who, you know, pretend to have a company. That's not to say it's not happening. I'm sure it is. I just haven't seen a lot of it.
Richard asks, how much does tax fraud cost the U.S. Treasury each year? I don't know if we have that stat handy, but what can be done to minimize the evasion? That is an area, you know, we've been covering, especially as the IRS has been under staffed in recent years, and you know, I think the pandemic is not helping things. We'll try to get that info to you, Richard, but I will say maybe we can end with Lucas had my favorite tax fraud story recently. It was a guy who you would think has no reason to be fraudulently filing his return. He had just won the Powerball.
He won the Powerball or the Mega Millions. I forget one of the two. He won like $1 million. And I gather he was a guy who was like kind of an inveterate gambler. Like he was just, you know, he was able to declare in his taxes, $1 million prize winning, income. But he also declared that year he had lost $1 million in lotto tickets and gambling, which seemed like pretty ridiculous. So, and he ended up paying zero tax. Fact was, he had actually only lost $350,000 that year. So he did, failed to declare $650,000 in net gain. So, you know, they got him on that. You know, I think that seems like, you know, probably pretty easily checkable. If there's one thing that's like kind of weirdly fraud proof, it's actually the lotto. Like right. They really, really like this pretty transparent, like, you know, who the winners are, who wins what, how it gets declared. Like, I think, lying on your taxes about your lotto ticket winnings is like probably pretty foolhardy. And in his case, it certainly was.
He should have quit while he was ahead and bought a Lamborghini.
Yeah, right. Yeah, sure. Right, exactly.
All right. Well, I'm sorry we didn't get to all the questions. We'll try to see if we can reply afterwards. But thank you, Lucas, for doing this today. Barron's Live will be off Monday in observance of Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Please join Barron's special event on Tuesday, A Better Economy, Inclusive Recovery. Thank you for listening and stay well. Have a good day.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.